today. Children may be dismissed. I had to wait for the big kid leader to stand up before I knew we were having it today. Well, Daniel is an amazing prophet. He's a man whose record of the history of his time is without equal. And when we read Daniel 5, we're actually reading an eyewitness account of the fall of the Babylonian Empire by someone who was a prime minister of that empire himself. And even though he was a prime minister in a pagan culture and a palace of Babylonian monarchs, he never compromised his faith in the true God. And today, we're going to look at the story of the writing on the wall. We'll only get up through about verse 16 this morning, and next week we'll finish the passage. But we always like to put it into the context of today, and how does this fit today, and how do we relate to this, how do we relate to Daniel, how do we relate to the culture of that time. So that will be the direction that we're heading in as we move along here. But if you've noticed, every time that Daniel appears on the scene, we find that he is somehow unrelated to everybody else that's there. And I don't mean in the physical sense or the biological sense, but he's unrelated to the situation at hand. He always makes a grand entrance alone. He's never with the magicians and astrologers and enchanters and the Chaldeans who come to give their human wisdom. So he is set apart as God's man for this very hour, and it's recorded for us for eternity. And I was thinking about that, how Daniel, you know, he's going about his life, he's living his life, he's being obedient, he's in a not the most desirable situation. He'd rather be at home, he'd rather be back in Jerusalem, he'd rather be back with his people in his city and be serving his king instead of serving a pagan foreign king. He was taken as a hostage, as a captive, when Nebuchadnezzar overtook Jerusalem in 586 BC at the first attack. But God had a plan for Daniel. And it may not have been Daniel's plan, but it was God's plan. And God set him apart as his man for that hour. And in our situations, you know, if you are a child of the king, then you've been set apart as God's person for this very hour. In Acts chapter 13, verse 36, Paul is giving a sermon. One of the first sermons he preached that we have recorded for us, and he says, "Now when David had served God's purpose in his own generation, he fell asleep and he was buried with his ancestors." So the emphasis there is not so much on David, not so much his ancestors, but when David had served God's purpose for his generation, he died. In Esther chapter 4, we all know the story of Esther, and she was the queen, and her people were about to be annihilated because there was a certain right-hand man of the king named Haman, or could be Haman, and he was angry because Esther's uncle named Mordecai would not bow down to him in the king's courtyard. So Haman went to the king and he said, "I would like everyone in his family to be put to death." And the king said, "Okay," not knowing that Esther and Mordecai were related. So he set a certain month and a certain day when the Jews would be annihilated. Well, Mordecai went to his niece, Esther, and he said to her, because she was hesitating to go to the king, and he said, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So Uncle Mordecai says, how do you know that you were not born for this exact moment to save your people? And then, of course, Esther saved her people. And one other example that I have is Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5. God tells Jeremiah, before you were born, I set you apart to do my work. And we know from the scriptures, and Chad mentioned this in Sunday school today, Paul tells us in Ephesians that before the foundations of the earth were set in place, you were chosen to be God's child. Before you were born, God says to Jeremiah, I set you apart. So you, wherever you are, God has put you there, and you are to serve his purpose in your generation. And we'll come back to that at the end. As we come to Daniel chapter 5, we see the end of an empire. In fact, it's the end of the most glorious empire of the times of the Gentiles, maybe the most glorious empire of all times. It's by far the largest empire. We've seen already where the Babylonian Empire ruled the whole known world at that time without any resistance. God gave that to Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel tells us. He had no enemies. They were prospering, we saw last time, and things were going well, and all was at peace. But now, as we close out chapter 5, we're going to see that this empire falls and a new empire is transitioned in. Back in chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he saw this big statue, and it had a head of gold, and the chest and the arms were made of silver, and the midsection was made of bronze or brass, and the ankles and the feet were made of iron and clay. And we saw that that statue was top-heavy because the value of gold was so much more than silver and bronze and clay that Daniel's interpretation was, you, O King Nebuchadnezzar, your empire, Babylon, is the head, is the gold. And then we saw that the Medes and the Persians were the silver. And then as we went on, you got to the bronze, that was the empire of the Greeks, Alexander the Great. And then the Roman Empire was the feet of iron and clay mixed. And we saw how the kings and the cultures and the issues of the day caused the kingdoms to fall. Well, we find today that Babylon, the nation of Babylon, falls because it had deteriorated morally. It had gradually entered into a state of debauchery and a state of immorality and degeneration until the hour of its doom is finally pronounced. And suddenly and totally, the Medes and the Persians sweep in. And this is really interesting, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I will a little bit, because Babylon was an impenetrable city. There was no way to get in, no way to get out. There was no way that an enemy could overtake them. But yet in one night, in the sovereignty of God, the kingdom fell, and the prophecy was fulfilled, as told earlier, and we'll get into that in a few minutes. But the message of chapter 4 speaks directly to us today in 2016 here in the United States of America. The first scene in this chapter is filled with recklessness. It's filled with blasphemy and immorality and evil acts. And secular historians from that era of time have described it for us, but I would care not to assault your brain with such a description, because it's just downright horrible, really. In the midst of all the debauchery, and suddenly God intervenes and he pronounces doom on the whole empire. And it's a pattern that all civilization follows in one way or another. And that pattern is that a kingdom or a country, a nation, will rise to its heights. And at its height, it is filled with pride. And in the midst of its pride and self-indulgence and materialism, it begins to descend into degeneration and unspeakable evil until it descends and comes closer and closer to its destruction. In Psalm 9:17, it says that the wicked shall be turned to hell and all the nations that forget God. So the doom of a nation is determined when it forgets God. And so the empire fell in one night. The end came, and Daniel gives us the record. If you have your Bibles, I will invite you to open them. We'll read all 31 verses. And then, like I said, we'll comment on about the first 16 or so. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. And while Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. And the king called out for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought. And he said to these wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." And then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "O king, live forever," she said. "Do not be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means." So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory, and he was driven away from the people and given the mind of an animal. And he lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drank wine from them. You praise the God of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand, but you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written. Meeni, meeni, tekel, parson. This is what the words mean. Meeni, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. And Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. So, quite the story, huh? By the way, Daniel served under four kings, Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, Darius, and Cyrus, the very end. Daniel is now an octogenarian. You know what that means? Huh? Eight. He was in his 80s. He's no longer a teenager. He's no longer middle-aged. He's now somewhere between 80 and 90 years old. He's been a captive for more than 60 years serving in the king's court. So in the first four verses of chapter 5, we have the scene. And it says in verse 1 that Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles. So right away we're introduced to a man named Belshazzar. And that's very similar to Daniel's Babylonian name, which was Belteshazzar, right? Well, Daniel was named after a foreign god. When Daniel was taken captive, King Nebuchadnezzar changed his name to Belteshazzar. That was a form of the name of the god that he served. Belshazzar is also a form of the name of the god that Nebuchadnezzar served. And so these people were named after their gods. And in the first scene, we meet this guy, Belshazzar, and he is throwing a party for 1,000 of his nobles. Now, Nebuchadnezzar has died. Nebuchadnezzar reigned for 43 years, and then he passed away in 562 BC. But 23 years have passed since chapter 4 ended, which you will remember from last week was the great breaking of Nebuchadnezzar and his recognition of the true God. Nebuchadnezzar was filled with pride, was filled with arrogance. Remember, he looked out over his kingdom one night and he said, "Look at everything that I have done. It's all because of me." And at that moment, God's judgment came upon him and he was put out to pasture with the rest of the animals. And for 7 years, he lived like a wild beast. And after 7 years, God gave him back his reasoning and his discerning ability. And he came back and he said, "There's only one God, and that's the God of heaven. That's Daniel's God." And his noblemen and his leaders came back to him, and he regained the power of his kingdom. And I would say that Nebuchadnezzar most likely died a believer after that experience. But his children weren't. And Belshazzar most likely is not his son as such, but probably a grandson. But in the Hebrew language, there's no word for grandson or grandfather. Father is father, and father goes back for generations. So he's probably a second generation by now, because all of the first sons were assassinated because there were conspirators who were trying to take over the kingdom. And it's a big history lesson that I could give you, but we'd be here all day. But Belshazzar ends up on the throne just the same. And the empire is in decline. The Medes and the Persians literally surround the city of Babylon. They're everywhere. And depending on which historian you read, they'd already been besieging the city of Babylon from 2 to 4 months. And while all this is happening, it says in verse 1 that Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles. Now, this is a big deal. And I did a little reading on this. Because when they had a feast, when they had a banquet, they had a banquet. This was for 1,000 of his nobles, but that was small-time stuff for that time. For example, the Persian monarchs, we know from archaeological discoveries, were known to dine daily with 15,000 guests at one meal. every day. When Alexander the Great got married, ready for this, he had 10,000 people come to his marriage dinner. President Reagan had 400. And we were worried about stretching the food. Well, I wasn't, but people were. Assurbanipal II, you ever heard of him? Assurbanipal II. In 879 BC, archaeologists tell us through a banquet, including 69,754 guests for one meal. And I have no idea how they came up with that number, but I believe it. And the food. Athanasius says in one passage, 1,000 animals are slaughtered daily for the king. And these comprise horses, camels, oxen, asses, deer, and most of the smaller animals. Many birds are consumed, including Arabian ostriches, geese, and chickens. They really went for the food. And so he throws a feast, Belshazzar, right at this time. And it's hard to conceive that the guy would be that stupid, really, to get into a drunken party going while his city is surrounded by the enemy. But Babylon was so strong, and the world feared it so much that apparently the king considered them to be safe from outside attack. We'd say today that they were too big to fail. And maybe for good reason, because the city was supposedly 15 miles square, according to Herodias. The walls were 87 feet thick. And that would be from the front of this room to the back times three, roughly. You don't burrow through that. The walls were 87 feet thick and 350 feet high. And on top of the walls surrounding Babylon were towers that rose another 100 to 350 feet where they could watch what was going on. And they had 100 massive bronze gates in the city. And they had no problem with water because the Euphrates River flowed right through the middle of the city. So they had fresh water. They had sewage, so to speak, because it could go right out. But you know how the Medes and the Persians overtook the city that night? They built a dam upstream, stopped the flow of water, and the water got down to waist level, and the army walked through into the city and overtook the city at the very moment this party was going on by the providence of God. And we'll talk about that next week. So really, they thought they had nothing to fear. They had everything going for them. So Belshazzar gets up on his platform that stood above the people who were reveling below them, and sitting up above all of these 1,000 of his nobles having this big feast, he starts drinking wine. And the implication in verse 2 is that he became drunk. And he called for the gold and silver vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem back when he took Daniel and others hostage in 586 BC. When Nebuchadnezzar first went into Jerusalem in order to show his people that his gods, the gods of Babylon, were more powerful than the God of Israel, he desecrated the temple. And he took all the gold and silver vessels that were in the temple used by the priest, and he hauled them off to Babylon. He put them in a special place in the house of his own desires, of his own deity. So you can imagine, the warning that God gave the people through the prophets, through Jeremiah and Isaiah and the minor prophets about the coming judgment. And when you see this happen, where God's people, God chose the nation of Israel to be his people so he could show the world what happens to a people who choose to follow the Creator God and the blessings that they receive. But they chose to disobey him, to be like the people around them. And so what happens is that a foreign dignitary comes in, completely wipes them out. And then he says, look, my God is stronger than your God. Ha, ha, ha. And if he weren't, if my gods weren't stronger than your gods, then you wouldn't be where you are and I wouldn't be where I am. And it's a taunting factor. So then this all took place, and when the party is going on, in a drunken stupor, Belshazzar demands that they bring these sacred vessels out, and they're all drinking from them and carrying on and having a great time mocking the God of Israel. And it was a direct act of blasphemy and desecration and disrespect. Now, Belshazzar was not totally uninformed. He was not acting in total ignorance about God, because he knew the God of Israel. He knew the history about Nebuchadnezzar. He knew how the God of Israel had made Nebuchadnezzar a raving maniac for 7 years. He knew how God had been able, through Daniel, to reveal dreams and visions. He knew that God was great and glorious, but in the midst of his paganism and his foolishness, he decided to mock God. And he knew that such an act was totally blasphemous. And we know that because later on, when he was in conversation with Daniel, in this chapter, he talks to Daniel and he admits that he knows who Daniel is. And he knows about the Jews, and he knows where Daniel came from, and he knows the whole story. And so he takes these things out of the temple and he uses them to bring disrespect to God. And basically, he's challenging God. And God accepted the challenge. Belshazzar threw down the gauntlet. God threw down the gauntlet. And he says, let's have at it. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of, on a warm summer day, you have a few minutes, so you lay down on the couch and you're trying to take a nap. You got a pesky fly. Bzzz, bzzz, constant, right? You fly, bzzz. Then pretty soon his friends come. Then you got two or three of them. Bzzz, and you can't get rid of them. That's Belshazzar. He's the fly. And he's buzzing around God. He's saying, come on, you know, try me. Come on, let's see who's the toughest one here. In verse 3, we see that they take these vessels and they misuse them. So first we have the scene, and now we have the sign in verse 5. In verse 5 it says, suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. So you can imagine, in the midst of all this revelry, and at the same hour, God says, the cup of my wrath is full. My spirit will not always strive with man. My patience has ended, God told Noah during the time of the flood. And immediately and suddenly and swiftly, when the offense was at its peak, a hand appears. And it might not even be a hand. It might just be fingers. It says that suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared. So imagine that there's this big party going on, everybody's having a good time, and all of a sudden over on the wall there's fingers with a writing utensil, and it's writing words that nobody can understand or even read. That would be very creepy. And you'll notice also that it was near the lampstand. It says in the place where the lampstand was, and that would be illuminating this wall. And lampstands were usually placed for the brightest lighting at the point where the king sat, because he was the crown of the occasion. So as the king sat in the spotlight, fingers appear, and they write on the plaster on the wall supernaturally. Now, German archaeologist Robert Johann Koldewey, he lived from 1855 to 1925, but he excavated ancient Babylon, and he says that their excavation of the palace of Babylon from the time of Belshazzar, they found in the palace a large room that was 55 feet wide and 169 feet long that had plaster walls. So all the way back in the 4th century BC, they had plaster on their walls. And that's amazing, because that's just what the Bible said. And also, archaeologist Cole DeWay said there was a niche in one wall where they believed that the king sat elevated. And so in that very setting came the fingers that wrote on the wall. Verse 6 says that his face turned pale and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. That's where we get the old knock-kneed thing. The King James adds a little more color to the description. It says, the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. He was a wreck, and he collapsed from fear, and his face changed. All of a sudden, you had this flush red face that had been warmed by the wine. I don't need to explain that to you. It suddenly turns ashen white, and he's troubled. But you know, he didn't seem to be too troubled by a natural foe that was outside the gate, but he was pretty well troubled by a supernatural foe inside the palace. And so sheer terror gripped that man's heart. So we have the scene and the sign, and thirdly, we have the shortcoming. Verse 7. It says in verse 7 that the king called out for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought, and he said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. So this bunch of people is still around, the wise men of that day. And they were useless the first two times they were called on in the book of Daniel. But what else can he do? So he calls in the brain trust, and he gives them the biggest incentive that he can. And in verses 8 and 9, it tells us that these wise men couldn't even read the writing in the first place. They didn't know what it said. Some people say, well, why couldn't they? Maybe God hid it from their eyes, or maybe they were so drunk they couldn't read the letters. But even if they could read them, they certainly couldn't make known to the king the interpretation. It says in verse 9 that his nobles were baffled. And that word baffled carries with it the idea of total confusion. In other words, as the writing started, it seems to be that it kept going. And the king screamed to his advisors, bring in the astrologers, the enchanters, the diviners, the fortune tellers. Get them in here. We have to know what this says. And there's mass confusion. People were running around and hopping around and trying to get to the bottom of it. So then we get to verse 12 and we have the summons. It says in verse 10, the queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. So the queen hears the commotion. And she says, O king, live forever. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. That's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar said about Daniel back in chapter 4, in verses 8, 9, and 18. He said, Daniel is one who has the spirit of the holy gods in him, meaning that he has a higher power. He has the Holy Spirit in him. He is not just going from earthly wisdom like you people are. And this queen, the queen mother, most likely, scholars universally accept that this is the queen's mother, was probably married to Nebuchadnezzar before he died. She said, Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man, Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind. And then she uses the most descriptive word she can to explain the intelligence and the wisdom of Daniel, a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. And so the king calls for him. And then when we get to verses 13 and 17, Daniel comes in. And you'll notice that Daniel, again, is not hanging around the rest of the people. He never hung out with the wise men or the enchanters. He just waits for his moment. He's just going about his life, living obediently to God, doing what God has placed him there to do. And they call for him, and they say, get Daniel in here. And Daniel comes in, he stands before the king, but he comes in, he stands alone before the king, just like he did when he was a teenager, just like he did when he was a mature man, and now that he is an octogenarian, 80-something years old, he still stands alone. There's never a compromise. And he comes in, and the king says, I know all about you, Daniel. And then the king gives him a history, and Daniel's not intimidated by this at all, nor is he interested in being a third ruler in the kingdom. And why would he be? Who wants to be a third ruler in a kingdom that's got a few hours to last? Kingdom's going to end in just an hour or two. And not only that, but the higher up you go in rank, the more likely you are to get killed. He wasn't intimidated by any of these monarchs, ever. And so we have the scene, the sign, the shortcoming, the summons. And then we find what's the heart of the matter, and that's the sermon. And that'll take us to next Sunday. But I want to frame this, like I said earlier, in the year 2016 in Martintown, Wisconsin, or South Wayne, Wisconsin, or Monroe, Wisconsin, or Lena, Illinois, or Winslow, Illinois, or Kent, Illinois, or Gratiot, Wisconsin, Freeport, Illinois, Monticello, Wisconsin. How does this relate to us? Well, let's say, first of all, I mentioned already, Daniel is just going about his business, doing his work, doing what God has called him to do. And what's God called him to do? God's called him to be faithful to him, to be obedient. Daniel says, I won't eat that food because it'll defile me. Daniel's friend said, I won't bow down to the statue because it will defile me. Daniel says to the king, I don't want your prestige and your fancy clothes and all that stuff because it will defile me. I want to obey God. I want to live according to the scriptures. I want to be faithful to you. This week, our daughter sent us a website. It's called Vintage Aerial Photos. And somebody had sent her a picture on Facebook, and she sent it to Preston and Megan, and then Preston and Megan sent it to us. And what it is back in time, takes you back in time. In 1965 and 1978 and 1991, somebody was up in an airplane flying around, and they show you the flight path of the plane. They were taking pictures of farms in the countryside all over the U.S. And you can go on that website, pick the state and the county, and put your address in there. And it takes a little searching, but you can find your place and what it looked like in yesteryear. And so on this property that we bought a few years ago, the lady that we bought it from has since passed away, but at her funeral, which was a year ago in January, her family said that Mom always loved to be in the garden. She was always out in the garden, all summer long, in the garden and canning and giving that stuff away. And that was just her life. It was the garden. And she was actually the president of the Homemakers Club of Wisconsin or something, I forget what, but she was a homemaker and she was a farm wife and she loved it. And she said, and so we're looking at this photo from 1978, and a lot has changed. The outbuildings, some are gone, some are, there's new ones put up. But as we look, we took a close look, and we could see her garden. We're like, oh, hey, look, there's the garden they talked about, and there's rows, and they go north and south, just rows and rows. And there's apple trees off to one side that are just startups, little trees that are now big, full-grown, bushy trees. And as we look closer, someone looked and said, hey, look, there's Joyce. She's in the garden. They had a picture of her in the garden. And that day, in 1978, that clear summer day, she was going about the task that she went about every day all summer. She was doing the work that God had given her to do, and that was to grow vegetables, can them, and give them away and to raise her family. Someone took a picture that froze her in time forever. And when we give that picture to her daughters, they're going to be moved beyond words. because that's the picture they saw of their mom. What if someone took a photograph of you any day, just pick a random day, what would they see? Because that's what your legacy is. It's what you're doing every single day. That's what Daniel did every day. He just walked in obedience. I was listening the other day to 106.9, which is Moody Radio, the Freeport. And they had a guy on there, and he said that back in the early 80s, he wanted to be a missionary, and he was sure that God had called him to a mission field to go overseas somewhere. And so he went to all these mission boards, and he applied, and he tried to become a missionary, and they all turned him down. He didn't have enough education, didn't have enough experience, just didn't qualify. And so he said he just went about his vocation of well drilling. He was a well driller in North Carolina. He said in 1985, it was early in the year, he went to a house to drill a well, and here it was Franklin Graham's house. And this was before Samaritan's Purse. It was just a startup back then. And so he drilled this well, and Franklin came out, and he said, "You think I got enough water?" And he said, "Yeah, you got enough water." And he capped it and did all the work and left, and he gave him his business card right before he left. The well driller did. And he said, "If you ever need wells drilled, give me a call." He said a year and a half later, he got a call from Franklin Graham. He said, "Hey, Ed," or whatever your name is, "have you ever thought about drilling wells overseas in poor countries?" And he said, "No, but I will." And so he went to Samaritan's Purse into these third world countries where water is a major health issue. And he began drilling freshwater wells using the technology and the experience and the knowledge that he had gained here in his vocation to go over there. And he's been doing that for 30 years. And he said, "I was just doing my work, and I was wondering, what does God have in store for me? And I was going through every door that was open, and I opened every door that I could." And he said, suddenly out of nowhere, he said, "I got a call to go." So, with that said, and with your reputation in mind, or your legacy, whatever you want to call it, in our Sunday school classes this quarter, however we measure it, we've been talking about the fruit of the Holy Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, all of those things. And if we're growing, maturing Christians, there'll be evidence of the fruit of the Spirit in our lives in some form or another. Jesus said that a good tree grows good fruit and a bad tree grows bad fruit. So what kind of fruit are you growing? And how are you as far as it comes to walking in the will of God? You know, a lot of times I talk to people and people say, I need to do more. I just don't have enough time. My life is getting shorter and shorter, and there's so much I need to do for the Lord. I just don't know where to begin or how to do it all. And my advice usually is, why don't you just do what God's given you to do today? God's not necessarily calling you away from here to go there to do this, but he's calling you to be faithful day in and day out. So here's your assignment for this week. And it might seem a little bit odd, but take it in the right context. That is, don't look for an opportunity from God. Rather, ask God to bring it to you. Now, you have to be aware, if God brings it, you have to know that it's there. So I don't mean just close your eyes, but I mean ask God to do the legwork, to work behind the scenes. Ask God to make it happen. And then be ready when God plants it in front of you. Just like the well driller, just like the gardener, just like Daniel, just like Jeremiah, just like Esther, be faithful. Dear Lord, thank you for this lesson and so many more. And Lord, I pray that we will be faithful above all else, and that we will be expecting your mighty hand to move. And I pray in Jesus' name, amen. Okay, I thought I had lots of time, but I didn't. So let's stand, and we're going to sing Days of Elijah.
in the days of Elijah, declaring the word of the Lord. And these are the days of your servant Moses, righteousness being.